Sandy O'Neill.
Thanks, Mike. Can everybody hear me? It was a good overview. Mike just two different techniques to look at diets of killer whales and estimated proportions of various species in the diet using those techniques. So I'm going to give you talk about yet another technique and a whole set of other estimates for what proportions of Chinook and other salmon are in the diet. And they're not necessarily good or better or worse, they're just different. And the idea is just sort of try to pull together a whole bunch of information from different sources and see what you have to say. So one of the big differences about the sampling techniques is that scales and fecals, genetic samples on fecals, both actually contain lots of information about very discrete times and places that you've just been hearing. We don't know if we're sampling, fecals are sampling over the range of where they are. In contrast, stable isotope data gives you very coarse information about the diet, but over a much larger geographic range, as well as a temporal scale. Many of you probably know a lot more about stable isotopes than I do, but some of you don't, so I thought I would just, since I'm going to be talking about all these jargony terms, just do a little primer here. I don't mean to talk down to people if you already know this, I apologize to you. Okay. So the stable isotopes are natural tracers of the way elements move in nature, and both carbon and nitrogen, they're heavier isotopes. Measured as delta N and delta C on this graph. Sorry, I can't do it on both sides. Anyway, so both of them get enriched as you go up the food web. And so delta N in general is a very good indicator of appropriate position. So the higher up you go, the higher your number, the higher you are on the food chain. And on average, and I want to stress average, I'll come back to this point later, on average is about a 3.4% increase per trophic step. That means when you're going from this fish to this fish, you're looking for an increase here, like 3 points on the scale. And again, I'll come back to this point later. Carbon, in contrast, does not get trophically enriched very much, and it's in fact a better indicator, at least in the marine system, of the production source in the food web. So, in general, you get more offshore fingerprints of carbon, less enriched carbon, the more offshore you go, and the more onshore you come, and the carbon numbers actually go down, negative, they're getting enriched, so you get enrichment. So here's some stable isotope data for killer whales. We collect these with a biopsy sample from the skin, so they take a dart and they get back this tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of skin, and they measure the stable isotopes. And these are about 30 or so samples, I think, mostly from about 2006 onward, mostly for J&L cod. Most of the samples are collected in that summertime, you know, April to September, whatever we're calling it. There's a few, though, at the beginning and ends of the year. This is just to show you some of the ranges. Eric had a look at the data and did his magic little manovas of whatever he did on them. And he looked at the variability, both within years and pods, as well as season. And it looks like, at least at first blush, there's a lot more variability by year than there is by pod. However, there's a lot of noise. Interesting, there was a little bit of a suggestion of a slight declining trend in their stable isotopes as you go through the year. So what you're seeing here is nitrogen is going down through time, thinking that will be consistent with eating lower trophically, like a switch perhaps from Chinook to coho or chum in the fall, or different food other than that. The carbon is also getting enriched. The carbon is also going down, meaning a more offshore signal. Okay, so it's consistent with something offshore. We, again, because there's a bunch of variability, we decided to just look at one time frame. We had 12 stable isotopes from September. Diet data we were looking at from snails suggested that they were still eating a lot of Chinook at that time and hadn't shifted to chum, so that's how we started looking. And we wanted to compare stable isotope signatures here with different prey species collected. We did actually two different kinds of mixing models. One is the classic mixing model, which I'll just tell you about in a second, where you we estimate these trophic enriching factors, how much nitrogen and carbon is enriched as you go up the food web. And then we did an alternate one where we said, never mind the trying to estimate what these looking at trophic enrichment factor, we're just gonna generate them on our own. I'll walk you through that as well. So the basics behind a mixing model is that if you know the stable isotopes of the consumer, the whale in this case, and you know the stable isotopes of the prey, and you know how much they're enriched in the food web, species-specific tests for nitrogen and carbon, then you can estimate the relative proportion of each prey item in the diet. So again, we've got 12 stable isotopes for that time of year. Mostly females. Almost all of the samples were from 2008. There was eight of the 12 from 2008. I think there were a couple from 2007 and 2009. The salmon data, I'm not going to go into the sampling design, but those were collected as part of this related study, and I'm only looking at the salmon in the Salish Sea area. We have salmon data from Muskegon, et cetera. But since we were just looking at the time window in the fall, we restricted it to populations that were around this area, or at least in January. So we had about 115 Chinook samples. These are whole body samples. About 30 each of the other species. And then I didn't have any steelhead data, but I got some Tom Quinn. He'd done some fillet samples. So all the other species are whole bodies, but the steelhead are in place. So here's the data before we put it in the mixing model. So these red dots are the killer whales, okay, that's the stable isotope signature. You can see they're higher Chinook than Chinook, but not that much higher. Here's the Chinook, salmon, coho, and then these other sockeye, steelhead, and chum. We didn't put pink in the model. The problem with stable isotope models, and we only got two isotopes, is they're not very discriminatory, so want to keep down the number of items. So we threw out some chum and stuck some steel in there just because that was what we're showing up. Throw out the pink, sorry. Thank you. So the first thing you'll notice is that the Chinook and coho are higher trophically, as you expect. And then the chum, sockeye, and steelhead are lower. Interestingly, it also picks up the onshore and offshore movement. So Chinook and coho have real coastal distributions. They're feeding in coastal environments most of the year, whereas the chum, steelhead, and sockeye basically are offshore feeding most of the time. So what we've got to do before we actually run the model, we've got to correct for these trophic enrichment factors, and the question becomes, what trophic enrichment factor? Remember I told you there's an average of 3.4? Well, that's across the whole ecosystem. So we started looking in the literature. Dave Furman found one reference of but then he wasn't happy with it. He decided to go with some stable isotopes from the Gulf of Alaska killer whales. So Gulf of Alaska resident killer whales also feed on Chinook, or believed to feed on Chinook early in the year. So Dave took some stable isotope data from residents in that area, and he compared them with some Chinook from that area. Again, a small data set, but that's the start. So here are the stable isotopes. This is what Dave Herman measured based on the Gulf of Alaska. This is one study that was published. It's a captive study. It was N of 1, and the whale died. So we're not sure if these are good numbers or not. There's some other unpublished data from a captive study at SeaWorld. They measured stable isotopes in the whales, but they didn't measure the stable isotopes in the prey. They were taken from the literature. And then This is an interesting one. We're again, some analysis that they permitted. We had some transient killer whales feeding in Hood Canal over a period of a couple of months. They were observed feeding on harbor seals, so we did some analysis on the stable isolation of the transients and the seals. So this is the range that we're looking at. We went with initially the mixing model. We went with this number. In part, we didn't have some of the other numbers. This was an evolving process, but that's the number we used. So when you do that, you see that the stable isotopes come down in the middle. So this is what you're trying to do is get the model to solve for a mix of species that's going to give you an average isotopic signature right here. Now, anybody that does mixing models will tell you this is really bad symmetry because you can get many, many different proportions or different ways to get Chinook and Chum adding up to this number or Steelhead and Coho adding up to this number. So it's not a great model. Ideally, you'd have a more of a triangular shape. I might start to call this the salmon line, by the way. I haven't thought about salmon. Here's our estimates for TEF corrections, and I'll show you the results of the first model. So this is the classic mixing model, and it generates all the different proportions of Chinook and all these other species, and you get a probability distribution. So the model says that on average, in that time of the year, you get about, on average, meaning we about 43% of the diet would be Chinook. And our scale estimates I just talked about, about 70. That's pooled for DFO and NOAA. The fecal DNA results, again, we actually took the diets for April. I didn't mention this. We took the diets for August and September and averaged them because the skin is believed to turn over about every 2 months or so. So that's what we did. And fecal numbers, depending on which group you're looking at, which 68% to 90% show. So I go back to Eric and say, well, what can we run some of the other ones? Can we look at some other values? And Eric said, let's take a different approach. Instead of running all these different TEFs that you have, these different studies, they're not verified, we don't know if they're good or not. Why don't we use some data that we feel a little bit more confident about, like, for example, the scale data we have, and use that in conjunction with the stable isotope data to sort of constrain the diet that they're basically what you're doing is you're giving more weight to known prey choices. And then from this data, you can actually generate the TEFs. And you can then compare modeled TEFs with the ones that we've reported in the literature that we measured. So that's the sort of gist. So the benefit is that when you put these two things together, the isotopes and some of the scale data, it allows you to estimate the TEFs, and then you can turn it around and ask the question, what would the TEFs be if the stable isotopes would be to be consistent with the scale samples and the genetic samples? So it's sort of turning it models, you know. For this data, he used some scale data, and he just used the Northwest Fisheries Science data, there was 52 scale samples, I think. The fecal samples Mike just talked about, it didn't have a lot of, it had limited measures of uncertainty, so Eric used that as a prior rather than modeling his data. So here is now the second model, the alternative model, where you use the scale data, existing scale data, to sort of help you constrain the diet. And this time we get about a 72% median proportion of Chinook in the diet, which means that the scale data, of course, is really, really heavily weighting the isotope signature. And so not only do you see an increase in Chinook, you also see again, the model is not really good at distinguishing between lower-level species, steelhead, sockeye, but So, let's see. So, what kind of TEFs should we get from this? When you run all the different proportions, you find out that the median nitrogen TEF is about 1.65, which is a bit lower than the other estimates we had. And the nitrogen was 1.65 and the carbon is 1.18. So they're definitely a little lower than what was reported. We don't know if they're good or bad or not. They're just different, lower. Also, we put in the confidence intervals so you can see where they are. But in general, you know, you're not getting things up above 2. I'm not going to show you the results from the priors unless you really want to see them, but they didn't really have much of an effect on the estimates of the TEF. It's just a weak influence. But they made the TEF values more precise. So, what does all this mean? Stable isotopes from all of the genetic scale samples that we pulled together all indicate that the Chinook are dominant in September, followed by Cobra, but the estimates vary based on the method. I just thought I'd summarize them here. So here's the isotope only model. This is the isotope model with some scale data. These are the fecal to different years because Mike was showing some variability. This is some of the Saka years. So in general, we think the proportions of Chinook in the diet are a little low compared to some of the modeling, at least what's measured. Here's the summary of the TEFs. Again, these are the model TEFs. Down here for the southern residents, estimated from the mixing model. They're, again, lower. It's actually, though, within the realm of possibility for transient killer whales. Again, we don't know if any of these are correct or not. In general, you might expect to see something between 2 and 3. So some reasons for why our models might be a little low, or our TEFs numbers might be a little low. Mostly the first set are technical. So the first is maybe they're not low. Maybe the TEFs that we reported in studies were too high. The second is that we're looking at different scales, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. Stable isotopes are incorporating over larger areas, so it's quite possible that these whales actually fed further afield, further north. They switched from chum further north and moved east coast. So depending on where they were, that might have made a difference. There are also different techniques were applied to different years. So almost all our stable isotope data were from 2008. Some of the fecals different years, the scales for different years. I don't know if that's going to make a difference or not, but certainly a possibility. And also, we're not certain of the biopsy for the killer whales. We don't really know that it represents 2 months. We're guessing that that's what it is based on the turnover rates of some other marine mammals. But we directed run another model using just September data. Here are some more interesting, though, biological hypotheses that could be going on. The first was that the southern resident killer whales might be eating more juvenile Chinook than we think. And I have some data, and I can show you if you're interested, but there's some evidence for decline, a slight decline in trophic level with smaller fish, although it's a very slight decline and probably is not significant enough to account for the lower TEFs that we're observing in the model. The other scenario is that, one of the other scenarios, is that the resident killer whales are eating some other lower trophic species that's not detected in the scale sampling or difficult to detect with genetics. And so we did go ahead and look at some other species people have been talking about. What about the halibut? What about the English sole they eat? So these are mostly all collected in our lab. These are data from the International Pacific Halibut Commission, and they're actually not Washington data. They're BC coastal data. So there's a bit of a disconnect on this one, but all that's going to really do is push their stable isotope signatures for carbon this way. The nitrogen is not really going to change much. So here's the salmon line, you can see. And that lingcod and rockfish, these are actually from central sounds. Their carbon signals are a little enriched as you go into Puget Sound. All the carbon signals get enriched in the Puget. So they're pretty feeding as high as Chinooks are in. So it's not like the lingcod or the rockfish are going to be, that's not what's going to be causing a lower TEF. It's not the halibut. The English sole are lower trophically, but they are more benthically oriented, and they have a much more enriched carbon signal. So it's hard to get over to this line with the sole. So it looks like it's really mostly a salmon-related story. Possibly herring is really close to the line, obviously. They're small, and we haven't seen them in the diet very much, just occasionally, and we're not sure if they were incidental prior or not. And the last thing is that it looks like there could be, the TEFs could be a little low because, in fact, we're missing a little bit of something, at least at this time of the year, in our scale samples from in fact, are eating a bit more chum or sockeye. Steelhead's not cartwitch. Suggested that might be going on. And again, the whales are moving around. They're not in the Salish Sea all the time. So if they're moving, the chum runs come into British Columbia sooner than they do in Washington State area. So, you know, they could be actually traveling. So that's it. I don't really have conclusions. Mike's been asking me for days what are my conclusions, and I don't have any conclusions other than the stable isotopes are just another tool. And we started out, I think they've been very helpful for us. We started looking at the stable isotopes saying, there's no way these fecals are right, you know. And so we've actually come together and we've seen some nuance in the fecal sampling. We've looked more carefully at it. So there's definitely some subtlety there. I think it's pursuing a little bit more, but I think it gives us a more holistic picture about what the diets look like.
Can you say more about what you know about the just turn over and take a look at one point you mentioned skin 2 months?
What species, Doug, is the turnover rate based on? A bottlenose dolphin. So what they actually did was measure how long it took the skin cells to regenerate from top to bottom, you know, move from the bottom to the top of the skin. And it was about 72 days. So that doesn't equate to turnover rates, but that's the only estimate. So you could model it less. You could make it a month. And certainly, so we took half of the diet of August, half of September, you know, it was probably we should wait a little bit more, but this was the modeling.
I'm wondering about where human data harbor seals. And I'm thinking in two respects. One is what is their isotope signature within the Salish Sea, and second, whether there's more captive data.
So we did measure harbor seals. That's what this study is here. So let's see. So value. This is the TEF for harbor seals versus transient. So we do have some harbor seal data. I don't remember the exact number. I know that there's others. Katrina Ross has some, and Tim Jeffries as well. They've done a lot of some clean value studies. And, all the whale people always tell me that it's a big difference between pinfish and cetaceans. So I'm a fish person. So So we do, there is some out there.
Are they comparable? I mean, I'm particularly interested that the carbons are so high.
Well, I think the carbon enrichment is high here because I think you're getting movement from an offshore source onshore. So you're getting like some salmon that are coming and getting into the diet, right? They're not, that's what I think is happening. You're getting, when you go down that salmon line, you've got some chum that are, they're not local. So they're offshore, but they're migrating in and they're bringing that carbon signal with them. So that's why I think these are really hot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more maybe just from captive animals.
We found another study on fin whales and another one on harp seal. They were much lower. So, I think it was about 1.3, I think, for carbon. But you're supposed to use some species specific, so I can talk to you. I'm just stuck with this.
I was surprised when you first used the model how much steel did you have.
Oh.
They did like 35% or something. And so it's down to the amount of retreat from what's used to be. So you didn't think there was really a lot of steel like this. So we're just restricted to what we think of the
chart. Sure. I could take that out and he could take it out and run in. I think that definitely what's happening is steelhead is a little bit, it's a little bit more offshore, I think, and so it gets pulled into the model. It's just
one of them is to just put in the species that they dominate the diet from the people and scales and things. How well does it do selecting from those? You restrict the model to just those?
Well, that's sort of what you're doing when you put the scale data in there, right? You're sort of you're making the proportions in the isotopes match up with the scale. So that's sort of what you're doing. Yeah, we could take it out, and I think we'll be able to do
that. I've seen that used a lot. When they add the other scale, they move the whole scale down.
Scale data, I'll go back. So here you can see, this is the steelhead graphic over here. Okay, so this is what it was originally, and it went down. So when we put the scale data in there, it basically said, put more emphasis on things I know it eats, like cocoa at that time of year. So that's exactly what happened. Steelhead became less important. So really, you're using
thanks, Ian. It's really great work. I'm wondering, have you searched for other alternative lower levels of carbon types known to be consumed by southern residents? I think it might be useful or interesting to look at squid because.
Yes. We do have a little bit of squid data collected from Puget Sound. They're not lipid corrected. And so it messes up their numbers a bit, and I don't have the numbers to correct them. But if I'm remembering correctly, squid that I did see in the literature, and I just, let me pull up that graphic and I'll show you where I can remember the squid. didn't match the species from the behaviors. I don't know if we have new data on which species. There was small and all of them.
John, that's the one you asked.
There's two stranded southern residents out on the outer coast in our data set where the stomach pundits consisted only of chinook and squid beaks. Squid were, I think, the species, but rather large fish.
I think
there are two fish. Yeah, there are two fish. There are like that. So I'm just curious, you know, it's a species, it's a prey type that wouldn't know.
This seems to me to be a very important line of inquiry. We think we're on a lot of problems that we have to sample people to stay up. I would encourage you to do that.
I think what we'd like to do is do some calibrations early in the season when we think adjusting the chinook and do comparisons that way. You can see if we can get a better handle on what the TEFs are. We can look for some other species like harvest that we don't suggest.
Yeah, I would encourage you, though, I mean, I just understand the sample size of the but do you have essentially information from the whales, essentially 12 whales?
We have about 30 whales in total that we have single isotopes for. I think that's about right. But this analysis was done on 12 from September. So I didn't want to try to do this kind of analysis over introducing a whole bunch of variability. So I wanted to pick one time frame so we had the most number of scales in West.
Yeah, if you're going to use the scale visual material as a prior, you might want to consider 12 whales. You run the risk of simply regurgitating the information.
I think there are a few more stable isotopes. I think there are about 8 or 9 more biopsy samples in the freezer. I don't know if we're going to find those. But, they don't come in very often, so they're sort of opportunistic.
A lot of questions. So let me ask Tom and then I'll go to Chuck. Sorry.
Didn't you show that the results were not?
Yes, in this particular case. And that's because Eric also averaged. This was before we got all the detailed analysis from Mike, so we actually just put in an average fecal for August and September, and depending on which years we took, if we decided to take the early years that had just 2000, like this 2006 year that might have been soccer year, we might have been different. In fact, I believe when we ran the scale data only, we did another model in September, and we just looked at the stable isotopes for whales at that time using scale data for September. And I think at that point, the prior made a difference, right?
Yes.
I have the data. I can look it up. But it did make a difference. I don't know if you remember off the top of your head.
John,
you want to see it?
Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Chuck. I can see you. Really, I can.
Perfect. That's great. It's good to know you don't need it for yet. My question's about the Chinook. As you know, we've got were distributed more offshore. We also see that the composition of screen changes the diameter of the southern residents or the southern entrance area. So can you come to you how to weight or construct your samples when you come up with those 115 Chinook wrapped up sandwich season.
Oops. So, we actually took individual stable isotopes of a whole bunch of Chinook. And sorry, this graph is an old graphic that I haven't redone. So these are whole Chinook samples up and down the coast. It's largely just the killer whales, so you just ignore them for the time being. So here's a Puget Sound Chinook, and here's a black mouth right here. So there's a carbon enrichment as you come into Puget Sound. The Sacramento is a little lower. These are the Fraser. These are the these are fish that were sampled, let's see, from Port Renfrew, the Albion Test Fishery, and Robson Bight. And the stocks that were sampled include South Thompson and Mid and Upper Fraser. They don't include any Harrison. Separately, I do have some Harrison data from a publication with Donna Cullen and Peter Ross, did some contaminants on Chinook, and the contaminant, and I'll talk about this later today, the contaminant fingerprints in Harrison Chinook, as well as the stable isotopes, match Puget Sound. They have a more localized distribution, they're more onshore, so they're going to be here. We go further off. This is the Skeena, which didn't get included. So when I calculated my stable isotope to get started, I just took those Park and Koch indices that are so famous, and I basically took the last 4 or 5 years, and I said, what's the relative abundance of each of these species, of each of these populations? I included the Puget Sound, the three Fraser ones I just spoke to you about, plus the Harrison, and I did not include the Columbia River. So I came up with a value of about 15, I think it was. You know, the numbers are not going to change that much. They're really, you know, they go, there's only a tiny little bit. They're not going to affect the mixing model that much. So one of the other people said I should have put some Columbia River fish in there, you know, and that would have changed it. But in fact, the Columbia River fish that I had very much like Sanders, Columbia River. It's actually a Columbia River spring, a fall and a spring. The spring fish that I sampled were actually not the upriver population. It was a downriver population. So it has a more localized distribution. So I didn't really get, and I did the genetics on them as well. So that's how I got it.
So the Fraser
lady group, that's... The Fraser are not shown there. So I took their stable isotope signature from that Cullen paper, and I multiplied, you know, I did it proportionally based on the particle. So they got added in there. They accounted for, I don't remember the time frame, about 25% of the diet. Puget Sound, during this time frame, I think accounted for like 40%, so it was a little higher. But the Harrison is, like I said, very close to being sold.
Yeah.
John's been waiting for
it's a quick one. You're assuming that the diet and the biopsies and all the stable isotopes are indicative of diet. What if there was, what would a fasting effect in those 2-3 month window?
Well, I'm not a stable isotope expert, but I guess you can get some enrichment of nitrogen if there's fasting. Nitrogen will obviously go up. I talked to Gina Uotalo about this, and they that they're doing this kind of stuff, and I don't want to. And so their opinion was that if you were fasting, that you might burn the nitrogen in your muscle tissue more quickly than you would in your skin. The skin is very sensitive, and it's very necessary to protect for diseases. So there'd be a lot, that probably the last place that you'd burn through your nitrogen. That was their, they thought if you were really starving, that it would come from your muscle tissue.
I comment on that too. Yes, I mean, primarily fat animals in general will not even touch their protein until their fat stores are really limited. And cetaceans, dolphins will hold on to some fat stores, but the muscle is a huge source. And when an animal is in extreme jeopardy, it will go for her. And so you would actually see some really big fat off animals at that point. But the other comment I was going to say is I think this work is really important to show that even without adding the constraints that did show that Chinook was still important.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, I think we need to realize that this approach separately has a lot of assumptions as well, as been mentioned, and the turnover rate is really critical, particularly since it was a category of dolphin. that you would expect that maybe ambient temperature might affect turnover rates. And also some species, you know, turnover their skin very rapidly, lugas. So having as much as we can from other related species is important, but because there's so many assumptions in this as well, it's really important to do the constrained approach and try to look at everything in a complementary way, and your approach of just selecting the September samples are really good because of the variability that can occur over very long. So if you have more biopsy samples, great, but it takes some time.
I think we'll actually look at the April, May, and pool them. If we pooled April and May biopsy samples, and they would have done some similar sooner. I don't know what a prior is.
My reaction to listen to this conversation is that, you know, the real uncertainties are in your trophic practice.
Yep.
Recent reviews of trophic fractionation.
Yeah,
They have. They say they're like most other terrestrial, well, like terrestrial carnivores. They're on the order of 3 to 5. And you know, there seems to be there data that you bring in to mix them all as priors on the trophic.
I was wondering if there's been any effort to look at how these skin samples compare to the average isotope values from the two samples done in the Newsom study. Because Helen, they had three whales that they had to annualize, they were moving that way, but then you had an average for the year, and you can see if your seasons are higher or lower than what the yearly is.
I am unaware. Maybe somebody else in the audience is, but I'm well beyond my.
So it's lunchtime.